When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass. With me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton. This week, we talk to Dr. Tessa Hartman about life in the fashion industry, debate plastic surgery with Dawn Ward, and talk to Nicola Thorpe about why contraception is sexist.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
Now, we've talked about plastic surgery before, but our next guest is such an expert. She's actually got her own plastic surgery studio. Dawn Ward, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Welcome.
So tell us a little bit about Sculpt and how it came to be. What kind of plastic surgery do you do there?
So we don't actually do plastic surgery. I actually promote non-surgical procedures. Mm-hmm. Times have changed and you can do so much non-surgically now. But I am still a little bit of a fan of plastic surgery if needed, because there's some things that our clinic can't fix. So, yeah.
Fix is an interesting word.
It is.
What is wrong with them?
Wrong with who?
Well, wrong with people who apparently need to be fixed.
Well, it's not about being fixed. I'm a big believer that, you know, we're in the 21st century and, you know, 100 years ago you couldn't bleach your hair. Now we can, hence the reason I've got blonde hair instead of black. I'm a really big believer that, you know, in moderation. If you're very unhappy with something, or it can be altered, for example, I've actually just gone, I'm 45 years old. I've always taken care of my skin. I've always drunk lots of water. But it's quite hereditary to have saggy eyelids. And it really made me feel really conscious and self-conscious that I used to wear quite a lot of black makeup to try and cover it. I tried to have Botox to lift the eyebrow, and I went under the knife. Well, the knife, it's like I had my skin removed on my eyelids a few months ago. And I can honestly say that I am so much happier. I've got four children, and from Darby's 22, Taylor's 20, Charlie's 11 and Aston's 9. My eldest daughter was really conscious of her breasts, and to the point where she felt really unconfident in a bikini. That also has just happened to my 20-year-old, who lost a lot of weight. She gained a lot of weight because of a back operation and lost the weight going in the gym, eating healthy, by the way, you know, doing it the healthy way. And she was really, really conscious of her breasts because she'd lost all her breasts and she didn't feel comfortable in a bikini. And I got quite a lot of backlash on our show because I supported my elder girls to have a breast operation. And I'll tell you why I did that, because they're 22 and 20 and they're adults and can do what they want to do. I would much rather they put the faith in me, be open and say, look, I'm really uncomfortable with this situation. And as a family, we got to the right surgeon, Darby first, Taylor very recently, only a few weeks ago. And, you know, they feel really body confident now. They train really hard. They eat very healthy. I'm not saying that it's all about having plastic surgery, everything in moderation. But there's some things that if you can make yourself feel better, or there's something that you don't like about yourself and you can change, I am a big believer.
Now,
so on the boobs specifically, just it for me, it's their age. So I didn't come into boobs until my 30s. Mm-hmm. And now I really like them. And their body's going to morph and change. And doing it so young, they're going to need another set of surgery, what, in 10 years?
No, not necessarily. I had my first breast implants myself when I was 21.
And have you ever had them changed or adapted? Are they the same?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. So I've always had an amazing breast. I was really happy. I was very body confident. Mm. Had my first daughter. I was laying in bed one morning. Mm. My husband went, "Where's your boobs gone?" I lifted them from under my armpit. Mm. And I did go along to the surgeon and said, you know, I was really, really proud of my breast previously. Mm. And when I had my first daughter, they completely changed. So I went along and I had my breast done. But the surgeon said to me at the time, you need to go, I'm not a big fan of big breasts, to be honest with you. Mm. But naturally, I had big breasts. So I didn't really listen to the surgeon and went for smaller ones. So a few years later, I had them redone. And I've had mine 21 years now.
And so because you had them done so young, do you think that's the reason why your daughters thought,
no,
this is the thing that I will do?
So my daughter was 2 when I had mine done, so.
But it's socialised, you know, to it being part of the norm.
It's a completely different reason why my daughters had their breasts done. In actual fact, mm, not just why I had mine done. My eldest daughter had no breast and she felt quite masculine.
What size was she?
An A. She felt quite masculine. She didn't feel feminine. And that's the way she felt. Mm. I respected that. And we got a great surgeon. And she's so happy now. I'm very body confident. My other daughter had quite a nice breast. You know, she was really happy. Didn't have a problem. Mm. Had a back operation. Gained a lot of weight. Went in the gym. Ate healthy for a couple of years. Lost the weight. But unfortunately lost a breast. And felt really, really conscious about them. So both... all three of us had them done for different reasons.
But it's actually the same reason, isn't it? It's the same reason, which is that we're putting a level of body confidence on things looking a certain way. And if they don't look that certain way, then we can't feel body confident. I would challenge you and say that actually, surely the ultimate result would be to feel body confident regardless of what you look like.
Well, how can you feel body confident if you don't like the way something looks?
But you can change your mindset around it. You can change how you feel about
Let me just set the record straight.
You can appreciate what your body can do.
Oh, I am super proud as a parent that I have brought the strongest women. I will put them in the room with anybody. They are the most confident ladies it's the most proudest moment of my life. And I cannot change their opinion about anything. They're very, very strong women. And they didn't feel confident about a certain part of their body. And I can honestly say that now, Darby had hers done a year ago. Everything else, she trains really hard, she eats healthy.
But don't you think that's because society has given them one dimension of beauty? No one's told your daughter, who had, you know, A-plus chest, that could be accepted as a beauty.
But she's not doing it because anyone else is telling her. She's doing it because of what she sees she doesn't like.
Well, this is what... But she gets a one-dimensional view in the world, because this is a challenge at the minute that we have with cosmetic enhancements, even the non-surgical ones. Is everybody?
It's a change in time. Well, it's the 21st century.
But everyone looks the same, because you look at the...
Nobody looks the same, though.
In the 90s.
We're all four ladies sat in this room and none of us look the same.
Well, that's because three of us haven't had any plastic surgery.
No, I have.
In the 90s.
No, that's not because we've not had plastic surgery. That's totally wrong what you just said there. That is completely wrong.
Come on,
actually,
are you telling me if I hadn't had fillers and hadn't had my lip, if I'd had my
you
fillers,
might
had my lips
it might
done,
not necessarily be something that you feel uncomfortable about or you necessarily need. Every single person is an individual.
But they'd be looking
and
the
I'm
same.
And I'm a big believer. No, we don't look the same because even my three,
come on,
me
we
and
do.
My daughters.
But in the 90s, the look was
their lips
in the
90s.
Listen,
if everybody could look the same,
in the 90s, everyone did because the fashion was massive boobs. How many women have we seen? Victoria Beckham is one of them. She had big boobs. That was the look. That is a look that made everybody feel confident and good about themselves. She had hers removed because that isn't the world that she operates in now, and she sees a different viewpoint.
I actually don't think they were that big, to be fair.
But that was the look, right?
So if
you and I think if plastic surgeons could make everybody look the same, they would be billionaires. Nobody can look the same.
But there's
everybody
a
is
look.
An individual.
But there's a
everybody's
look.
Everybody's an individual, and I'm a big believer that if you're going into plastic surgery because... And you do your research, you get the right surgeon, and everything is in moderation, okay? I actually promote non-surgical procedures. So can I set that record?
Surgery is moderation. Can I set that record straight? Putting somebody under general anesthetic is moderation.
Well, it depends what surgery you're having, because my eyelids, I was under local anesthetic, so.
Okay, but what's the point when moderation flips into body dysmorphia?
Yeah, that's when a different subject, but that's not what we're saying.
What's the flip? What is moderate?
Well, I think if you're trying to make yourself look a different person and mould yourself on somebody else, I do think there's an issue with that.
But don't
what
you think
I'm
we'd...
saying is, what we've not got to do is just categorise the whole of plastic surgery. Like my daughter's having the breast done, me having my eyelids done. That is not about me trying to morph myself into being and have the body dysmorphic. I'm very happy with who I am. I didn't like my eyelids. I've had them fixed. I feel fantastic. Look,
but you didn't like your boobs. You had them fixed. You felt fantastic. Then you didn't like your eyelids, so you had them fixed.
Yes,
so you
I've
felt fantastic.
Two fixed. And do you know what? I'm sat here
like
now.
Lips. At
I'm
one
sat,
point,
I'm
so sat, you had your lips fixed,
I'm,
and so on and so
I'm
forth.
Sat here now feeling fantastic, and that's what that life's about. Everyone's an individual, and
until
I think
you don't again.
Everybody. That isn't me though, because it's about moderation. It's a different subject. Body dysmorphia, when you're trying to mould yourself into someone else. All I'm saying is, look. Have you ever had your hair dyed?
Yeah, loads
why
of different
would you have
colours.
Your hair dyed? Why change
loads
yourself?
Of different
That's
colours.
Not why you was born. It's the same thing. It's the 21st century, and everything in moderation. And I feel, again, everyone should do the research and be totally, totally comfortable with what they're doing. But everyone's entitled to live the life how they want to live it, providing it's for the right reasons and you're not trying to go too far. Then I'm all for it.
But what
are the right
far
reasons
for
too
me?
Far.
So I'm with you. So I think. So An MOT, as I call it, is fine. I've had underarm Botox for hyperhidrosis.
Yeah, for sweating, yeah.
A bit of an MOT, I'm all down for. But there is a point where it goes, for me, too far, where there's a need to change the construct of your face.
I 100% agree with that.
And everything else.
And I'm agreeing
but
with
I don't
you.
Know if people know what the difference is, because they're looking at a visual of,
but
well...
that's a different scenario. I agree with you.
And that's what I'm trying to understand. What is that line when actually this isn't okay?
So people come into my clinic and they want...
Will you turn someone away?
I've turned many people away. Okay. Because for me, everything's in moderation. Mm-hmm. If you have non-surgical procedures, or for me, even plastic surgery, in moderation, very, very, very subtle. When you have something like that procedure done, or people come in my clinic, you should go away. Nobody knows what you've had done. You think, God, you look fresh. I've had girls, young girls, come into my clinic and they want 3 mil in the lip. And they're going to go out looking like Donald Duck. And we're like, you know what? That's not for us. We don't think that's the right way to be. And I totally agree with you. But I can't sit here and say that I disagree with plastic surgery. I think everybody in life has a choice to feel confident in themselves. And some people go on diet, some people don't care, some people change the colour of the hair. We're in the 21st century. Some people have a little bit of filler in the lips. I've had my eyelids done. My kids have had the boobs done. But you know what? I will never, ever step away from that, because my girls feel fabulous. They eat healthy. They train. They try and do everything the natural way. But there's some things that you can't change the natural way.
But what happens if they didn't feel fabulous? Why would that not be okay? Why would it not be okay to be like, do you know what? It would be okay. I wish I could change that, but I can't. And I'm just going to learn to live with it.
Well, there's some things that you can't change. And I agree with you. But we're in the 21st century. And if you can change something, it makes you feel better. I'm all for it.
So your argument is, if you can buy it, because that's better than actually working on yourself and loving yourself as you are.
Well, you can't work on yourself to make bigger boobs, because you can't make them bigger. But I do believe that you should love yourself. And it's not about that. There's a very fine line. Like I said, everything in moderation. My girls are confident girls. They're sensible. We had a family conversation. We got the best surgeons. They went through a number of procedures to make sure they were completely happy with what they did. They were, and for me, it worked. And that's all I can say today. And everyone should do the homework and take the time and don't rush into anything. But I do love my eyelids.
Dawn, thanks so much for coming to join us today. If people want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
Where can they find me?
Yeah, where can they find me, darling? Give us your social media.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So my social media, my Instagram is DawnWard4, and my non-surgical clinic is at We Are Sculpt.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, we are talking to the fabulous Dr. Tessa Hartman, one of the most successful female entrepreneurs in fashion. That's next on Badass Women's Hour XL.
The Fempire strikes back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
Now, our next guest has a CV for her services to fashion and textiles. We are delighted to welcome to the show Dr. Tessa Hartman. I don't know why I suddenly found that so hard. Dr. Tessa Hartman, welcome. It's lovely to have you.
Good evening. Lovely to be here, ladies.
So tell us a little bit about how you got started in the fashion industry.
Oh, gosh. I came out of university and I got a job in America, actually, an internship working with the Kennedy Foundation. And it was more events and things like that. And after a while, when I graduated, they asked me to go for an interview in a company in London. They were giving their account to them. So I got that job, kind of cut my teeth in what we call FMCG, you know. But at night time, I was always, you know, enthused by fashion, by, you know, the history of fashion, you know, the fact that for me, fashion is a barometer of our culture identity. You know, it's everything. It's bigger than what you read in a magazine. And so I kind of started doing kind of PR and things like that night time on the side to get a few pennies extra when you're at the start of your career. And that's how I literally built it up. And eventually I decided after about 3 years in London that I would go back to Glasgow and try and set up my own kind of fashion PR company. And so that's what I did. And at the time it was really interesting because in London, people specialised. So they were specialists in fashion and law and everything like that. In Scotland, that didn't exist. So a PR company, they did fashion and medical and law and whatever. And you're like, what? How can that work? So I kind of pitched myself as that kind of specialist. And everyone said at the time, oh, there just isn't enough business in Scotland. It's not going to work. But I hustled and I'm still hustling. And it turned out okay. I love it, I have to say.
Is Glasgow particularly quite a creative hotbed? I would have thought actually that because of the art colleges, the design up there, it feels like there is, that there would be an industry there for it, right?
Phenomenal. Well, look, you know, I think for me, you know, fashion is retail, you know, and it's about, you know, 25 years ago when I set up my business, Glasgow launched Glasgow Scotland with Style, and it was to reinvigorate the city and to attract investment and big retailers and luxury brands. So it was kind of the right time. So I was very fortunate in that I launched a lot of luxury brands in Scotland, from Louis Vuitton to Burberry to Armani to all these things. But there is a phenomenal art scene, a phenomenal music scene, and culturally, that for me is fashion. You know, fashion isn't just what we wear, it's the music we listen to, it's the style, it's art, it's painting, it's all of that. And Glasgow's thriving with that. I also like to think that, you know, regionally people, you know, London's the epicentre of the world of fashion in terms of Britain. I think people outside London have to kind of punch above their weight and try harder and try to do things, spend more time at it. And I think that's what Glaswegians do. I think, you know, we are workhorses and, you know, we like to showcase our creativity. And for me, you know, Scotland is a hotbed of that, particularly in the world of fashion with the art schools and all of that.
How has the fashion industry changed over the past 25 years? Because you've seen all the change. You've seen this move to fast fashion, to ethical fashion, to online fashion.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I kind of cut my teeth with my VIP database, and I worked really hard for years to do all these big parties and get all the right people going, as you know how it is. And the turning point came about 6-7 years ago when I was launching Burberry in Edinburgh. And they came to me and I was, you know, quite confident about my list. I knew I could get the right people to this party. And suddenly they said, actually, Tessa, we don't want your VIP list. We want the most influential Instagrammers and social media followers. And that was like 6-7 years ago. So my view at that point was, well, yes, that's fine. We can complement the list with, you know, an addition to, but, you know, your core customers and those VIPs, they should come to the event too. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't their position. And so almost it was a kind of turning point for me that I had to almost ignore this, you know, hugely influential database of, you know, people from not just Scotland, but all over the UK, that the world was now social and no one was caring about how much money you'd spent in a store. They were looking for people that could translate that message online. So for me, that's how it's changed in terms of a PR and a marketing perspective. And that's 6-7 years ago. So that was a kind of re-education, even at my stage, to try and you know, get with the team and go with the flow. I think, you know, fast fashion is a big issue for us. Yeah. You know, it's that kind of quandary and almost paradox in that everybody loves the clothes. We want to wear what superstars are wearing. We'll buy the cheap alternative, which is fine. And then we get upset because we realise they're being produced in India and China and they're not ethically done and there's no sustainability there. So there's a huge amount of paradox in fashion, of which we're all consumers guilty of falling into.
It's as you were talking, I was just rolling, I have an existential crisis every week on this show, but I was just rolling through, you know, all of the different issues that come with fashion and sustainable fashion. Anyone that's run a business for 25 years will have ups and downs and moments when they don't necessarily want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
What still gets you jumping out of bed in the morning? What keeps you committed to doing it?
Do you know, I think I always said that my business was my first baby. I have four children. I also think that we in Britain need to wear failure like our best shirt. Mm. That we're all, you know, we're so afraid of making mistakes and not doing well and having, you know, low periods. And I can tell you, I have had many, many low periods and many failures. But I think I'm very fortunate enough to love what I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I take on a lot of young graduates and I'm a big believer that you have to, A, love your trade, but learn and understand and cultivate your craft. I think a lot of kids go into different things nowadays, like even broadcast media, and they don't put in the time and they expect things to happen super quickly and they don't really learn their trade. I spent a long time learning my trade. I'm still learning my trade. You know, I read everything there is to, you know, to know in the world of fashion globally, because we have to, we have no choice, right? So I think if you can do something that you love and you accept that that is the nature of the journey, you know it's not the destination, it is the journey. I've had some great stories, I've met some wonderful people, and sometimes, you know, my kids will probably tell you, mum's never without the phone, and you know what, that's true. Mm. And this whole ideology of that these power women can do it all and everything looks great, it's absolute nonsense. You know, it's absolute, total and utter codswallop. You know, there are sacrifices to be made with your kids and your family every day of the week. But then it's choice, you know. And I genuinely love what I do. And I love, for me, I think the turning point when I got my CBE, which sometimes I still tap myself on the shoulder and think, oh my goodness, I can't believe that. For me, it's all about the nurturing of the next generation. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time working with a lot of young designers and giving them a showcase and platform to really show what they can do. And that's why I think it's really important to focus on the regions and give them the step that they don't have and the opportunities they don't have if they live in London. So I think seeing that talent progress and watching these guys that I've given a helping hand to is just, that's just joy. You know, these are the next generation of creators, and that for me is just wonderful.
Are any of them household names that we'd know?
Yes. I mean, gosh, all Scots, well, a lot of Scots, let's be honest. So we've got Christopher Keane, who is phenomenal now. We've got Holly Fulton. We've got Jonathan Saunders, who is now the creative director for Diane von Furstenberg. We've got a young chap who's called Charles Jeffrey. Have you heard of him?
No.
So he is a phenomenal talent. And I actually gave him an internship. You know, I ran the Scottish Fashion Awards when he was 17. Mm-hmm. And his mother was a secretary in a company. And she came to my office and she said, you know, my son is, you know, he's not settling in at school and he's very artistic and he's a painter and he's sculpts and all of this. And could you have a chat with him? And this boy had just incredible talent. You know, jump forward a couple of years, he's at Central St Martin's. He's the top of his class. He's now showcased at London Fashion Week. He's won an award as Emerging Designer of the Year at the Fashion Awards. He is eccentric. He is where art meets fashion. Mm. You know, he is a trailblazer. You know, so kids like this, I think, are great. You know.
What would you, what's the kind of mood, do you think, in Scotland when it comes to kind of entrepreneurship at the moment, particularly given the kind of recent referendum vote for Scotland and then Brexit? Do you think it feels like that as a country there is a sort of more of a move to get up and do things for yourself, particularly amongst young people?
Do you know, I think we live in incredibly uncertain times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's so many political questions, as we know, that are unanswered. And the independence wanted Scotland is still very much there. Yeah. I think that because of the uncertainty that presented in the high street, and a lot of brands that I was working with withdrew from the high street, they reallocated budgets from Scotland to Manchester, to Leeds and whatever. And that's a, you know, that was a real blow for the Scottish economy, and a lot of companies left. So I think that a lot of kids coming into this world, the interworld of fashion, are kind of, you know, contemplating, is it even possible there? Mm. You know, there aren't very many textile companies left. You know, we've got brands like Harris Tweed. We have some phenomenal weavers and tailors down in the borders. But it's a very difficult industry to get in. I like to say to people, I think, you know, if you understand and learn your craft in Scotland at the fantastic institutions, Edinburgh mm-hmm. College of Art, Glasgow School of Art, there's nothing wrong, and we shouldn't be ashamed of being Scottish and wanting to go to work in London or wanting yeah. to go to work in New York or wherever it is, you know, to get that level of education and experience. Because, you know, if you want to go to the Centre of Biochemistry, you'll go where that is. Mm-hmm. Just because you live somewhere else, you're not, yeah. not going to do that. So, but I think there is this kind of guilt-ridden inner psychology that, oh, you know, I should stay in Scotland. Whereas for me, you know, I'm trying to advocate that we are global citizens. We need to go where the work is and try and, you know, achieve that.
Yeah. We're talking to Dr. Tessa Hartman here on Badass Women's Hour XL. Still to come, we're going to hear more from Tessa. And before the end of the show, Coronation Street's Nicola Thorpe is going to be joining us to talk about some controversial articles she's written recently. She's been putting the cat amongst the pigeons. We love her for it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The Fempire strikes back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
With us right now, we have entrepreneur par excellence, leading light in the fashion industry, Dr. Tessa Hartman, CBE. Tessa, before the break, we were talking about kind of that entrepreneurial spirit in Scotland, and also that you talked about, which I thought was a fascinating idea, this sort of Scottish guilt about leaving Scotland to go somewhere else and come back.
Yeah.
You have gone back to your kind of to your home and to your roots. Do you think it's important that for Scotland they have like role models out there in the rest of the world talking about the brilliant stuff they do and they've learnt?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was one of the reasons why I set up the Scottish Fashion Awards. Mm-hmm. Working in London for all those years, I kept meeting these amazing, incredible Scots. And one of the things that British Vogue did brilliantly, going back to the 90s, they cultivated this, you know, Rule Britannia. You know, yeah. Everyone was talking about his catchphrase, brilliant, you know, and McQueen and all these people.
I remember
and it was
that
great.
Very
you know,
famous Vogue cover
you know,
they did.
It was phenomenal. I mean, just phenomenal. But they gave their talent this incredible platform. And so I was working in fashion and I met this guy called Albert Watson, Scott, living in New York, has shot over 350 Vogue covers. Who knows about him? No one knows about him. I kept on meeting all these amazing people, ranking the amazing fashion photographers, Scottish, yeah. And on and on and on, people in merchandising, people from Marc Jacobs, you know, loads of brands. And so I kind of just thought to myself, oh.
What, no, it's just, Rankin is Scottish. I think part of the reason that you don't know is because you don't hear it in their accents.
That's right. Yeah.
I guess when you lose it.
Well, he's lived here for so long. His mum was Scottish. Yeah, so absolutely, right. You lose it. But you know,
until you get tired or have a drink, and then
it
comes back out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it does. Yeah. But that's not an excuse, because you know we honour people all over the world, but we keep all that very close to our chest. Mm. Whereas the Scots are really not very good at that. You know, it's classic. I was having this conversation in my office the other day. You know, when someone says to you, "Oh, that's a lovely top," classic Scottish answer is, "I got it in the sale." Oh God, it was so cheap, it was a great deal. You know, instead of just going, "Oh, thanks very much," you know, it's just that kind of slight lack of confidence. Whereas, you know, I've been fortunate enough to do quite a bit of work in America, and it's the opposite there. Mm-hmm. My goodness, you walk in there, the can-do culture is just off the chart. You come out of, you know, meetings and you genuinely think you can rule the world. You know, I love that, and that's what we need to have more of. So yes, I think that, you know, and the great thing about social media now is that we have that opportunity to spread the word that, you know, we're, as I said earlier, we're all global citizens and we should be flying that multicultural flag and just shouting about it and sharing all our journeys.
I love it. So going back to the entrepreneurial journey, what are the things that you want to achieve within the business now? Do you have a vision for the next 25 years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my children, I was saying during the break, I've got four children, and my youngest is 12, so he's a few more years left of school, and Johnny, who's 14, but the girls have left. I run the business with my husband, and he's very much the creative, so he does music and production and animation, and I do kind of PR and branding. I think that's, in many ways, that's a problem, because running the business as well, we never stop. You know, we waking up in the middle of the night with an idea and we're like going into the studio or whatever it is. And we are as hungry now as I think, you know, we were 25 years ago. So I think it's just about, I think there are a lot of social issues. I think we need to be a bit more responsible in our marketing. I think we have to talk to brands about sustainability. I think we have to think about the environment. I don't think it's just a question of a quick buck and, you know, fast fashion. I think, you know, we are at a level of moral consciousness that we have to pass on to our children. It's almost that kind of moral duty to do that. And I think that everyone involved in the world of marketing and particularly fashion, when it's easy to take the quick, glamorous, aesthetical route, that we actually have to pull back and think, actually, where are we going to be? And also that domino effect, the little things that we do, particularly in fashion, how that, you know, resonates down the line to kids and doesn't have the results that we might have thought that it would have. So I think there's, you know, it's a big moral issue for me to kind of continue to build the business and work with brands that I genuinely think I can make a difference to, that they can make a difference to the world. And I'm fortunate, I'm working with a couple of brands that I'm really enjoying doing that with just now.
And would you turn down work if you didn't believe in the brief? So lots of money on the table. And we talk about this often, just running business.
Yeah, absolutely.
Money on the table, yeah. But actually from a values perspective, there's no alignment.
And we have done. Mm. You know, we are a boutique agency. We are not a big conglomerate with, you know, hundreds of staff. We've always kept the business small. And part of the reason for that was just so that we could actually manage our children and family life and a good business. Sometimes in the early years, you know, there are a couple of clients that I didn't turn down, and you know, we needed the money, and that was fair enough. But now, absolutely, I take on projects that I really love, and I'm really excited by what they're doing. And also, like I say to everyone, every day is a school day. Doesn't matter how old you are, there's always things to learn from people. And so, yeah, absolutely, I think we have to do that now.
And are your kids going to take over the business?
Oh, gosh, no. Well, I mean, the thing is, my girls, they'll probably chastise me. I've had them working in PR and events and runners since they were like 11.
Yeah.
And so one of them is a singer and the other one is doing marketing, social media for a finance company. But we kind of laugh because I've always had them work in every school holiday. I exploited them brutally. And so I think that's great, because now, actually, the older one, she said, you know, I don't actually realise how much I've learned because you can have forced me into doing it. And then she loved it, and she did lots of internships, so experience is everything now. And I also think there's that big shift of, you know, this conversation that I have with girlfriends about college, university, or experience going to work, you know. That's a big issue for a lot of people. I think that whereas, again, 20 years ago, it was all about having your degree and going down that route, and I think that's completely changed now. I think there's so many more incredible opportunities open for young people, and also fashion. You know, fashion is a huge area. People think of fashion, they think of catwalks and designers, but the business of fashion, you know, it contributes something like 29 billion to the UK economy. But there's ancillary industries as part of that, 16 billion to the UK economy, merchandising, you know, visual design, you know, all of this, a huge business. And I think people need to understand that to make the most of it.
What would you say to 18-year-old Tessa now, if you were going back in time? What would you say to her now?
I would say study coding.
Would
yeah,
you?
Coding's where it's at, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, for me, the opportunity to be a, I'm not very good at maths. My husband's probably sitting listening, killing himself at this and saying that's never going to happen. Had my brain, had the capacity, I would love to be able to code, you know, the combination of that computer technology and coding and apps with creativity. I think that's where the future lies.
Yeah, you know, that's infiltrating fashion as well, right? You get 3D printing. Mm-hmm. And there's 3D printing jewellery designers and, yeah, and like how fabrics are made now. And
phenomenal. Yeah, phenomenal. There's an incredible young British designer that I honoured in another event actually earlier this year called Richard Quinn. You might have read about him. He showcased at London Fashion Week, and that was the show that the Queen came along to. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. It was all over the papers. Mm-hmm. Well, he specialised in illustration and prints, but he was sponsored by Epsom, so he actually designed a lot of his print designs on their big printers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's all that technology now emerging, mm-hmm. which I think is just incredible for these. They are artists, essentially, aren't they?
Do you think the British fashion industry is going to change post-Brexit? Do you think it's going to, well, do you think it's going to give it a bit of enthusiasm and enlivenment, or do you think we're going to have to fight harder for our space?
Do you know, I think the generic answer is that British fashion industry would argue that they are not a big fan of Brexit, you know, that there's no secret to that. Being the optimist, my view is it almost doesn't matter what way I'm swinging politically, it is what it is now.
Yeah.
And so I think there is no harm in working harder, punching above your weight, being more competitive with your pricing, your distribution, thinking more of the consumer at the end of the day. You know, that I think there's lots of ways they're going to have to really tackle that, and they're just going to have to go on with it.
But the flip side, though, is unrest is good for fashion, and I say, and for culture across the board, because that's what sparks creativity. Actually, when things are quite boring and quite mainstream, it's reflected in the clothes. And actually, having volatility and a message to campaign against or for, or just people saying, do you know what, the system is so meh, I'm going to do whatever I want.
Yeah.
That's, I think, when we see exciting designers and
absolutely,
artists and
yeah.
creatives come through.
Yeah, and you can look at that through the ages. I mean, remember Catherine Hamnett,
mm-hmm.
you know, her slogan T-shirts, you know,
yep.
that was a kind of, you know, a political statement in fashion. Vivienne Westwood's mm-hmm. brilliant at that.
Yep.
You know, all these brands are making political statements, you know, and we're being forced into messaging in mm-hmm. fashion now, which I think is really important. But also we're being forced into that because the consumers are demanding it. You know, yeah. consumers, I think one of the biggest problems of fashion is that they underestimated the intelligence of the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with social media, we are seeing that consumers are savvy, their expectations are higher, their expectations of customer service are higher. They are, you know, they can get online and share that experience, which we didn't have to do. So people are being forced to work harder, which I think is good, you know, in terms of the service that you get at the end of the day. And fashion is a big part of that. You know, if you look at Theresa May, my goodness, that poor woman, what she's had to endure, whether you love her or loathe her. But would they analyse a man's shoes and his colour of his tie?
No.
Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't happen. I mean, it's incomprehensible mm-hmm. to me how still chauvinism in the world of politics, and we relate it to fashion, and there she's got her shoes, da-da-da, you're like, hold on a minute here, you know, this is not a level playing field.
Or analyse a woman carrying a handbag.
Yes,
yeah.
You know.
And now it's
really
it's handbagging. And I mean, it's
yeah.
just...
It's absurd,
yeah.
and it's kind of depressing in many ways that kind of attitude is still prevalent out there in society. But you know what, I just don't think that's ever going to go. So we can either moan about it, or we can go off our horse and actually punch it where it needs to go and keep producing these women that shows them how it's done.
Well, Dr. Tessa Hartman, thank you so much for joining us here on Badass Women's Hour XL. It's been lovely chatting to
you. Thank you very much.
Coming up, we are going to be talking to Nicola Thorpe, Coronation Street actress and equality campaigner.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Now, have you ever thought that the contraceptive industry could be sexist? I know it seems strange to say that because obviously, thanks to the pill, we've gained more women's equal rights. But our next guest says that actually it's just not a fair playing field out there. And in fact, women are being, well, I was going to say a term that I think is probably not okay at this time. Women are losing out. They're losing out when it comes to contraception. Nicola Thorpe, Coronation Street star and a fantastic equality campaigner. Tell us what you mean by the idea that contraception is sexist.
So obviously the methods themselves aren't sexist because they can only be used by females. But the idea that the industry itself is only targeting these pills or IUDs, devices, at women, it's the whole kind of culture behind it that is sexist because there isn't the same options. There just aren't the same options for men. They do exist, but they haven't been rolled out because pharmaceutical companies and investors don't deem them to be, they just don't think that they would catch on. They don't think that men would use them.
So some people say that the reality is that ultimately the reason we have contraception is because it is women who don't want to get pregnant and we are going to have to carry the child, and most of us are then going to end up literally holding the baby. Mm-hmm. So it seems like that's why there's more emphasis, because we're the ones that say, no, we don't want the children, so we have to then take responsibility.
Yeah, totally, of course. And women should and will take responsibility for their own bodies. But also, I don't think we're asking the question enough of what about men and men's rights when it comes to that kind of thing? Because at the end of the day, you know, obviously there should be a lot of trust in sexual relationships. It doesn't always happen. but men are putting their trust in a woman who is taking the pill, for example. And wouldn't it be nice to give men some control over their, not their bodies, obviously, because they wouldn't be going on to give birth, but control over their ability to father a child?
Yeah, because this is what's, I'm right with you. This is what's fascinated me. I read this article a few years ago, and it was like, men are fertile all the time. For a long time, women, we are only fertile for 36 hours a month. And I didn't even really know that. I didn't even really know my body until I started using the Natural Cycles app. Mm. And you start to track. And now I'm even more mystified as to why I was on the pill, why I had a coil fitted for so long, when actually now I know exactly when I'm fertile. But guys are fertile all the time. And you're right. Where are the range of birth control that we have as women for our 36 hours of fertility for the men who are fertile all the time?
All the time. There's damn sperm. They just live for so long in the womb.
And also, that sperm lasts for 5 frigging days. So on my Natural Cycles app, I can't have unprotected sex 6 days before ovulation because of the sperm, not because of me.
And there's millions of them. You've only got one egg. Exactly. Like, this is really unfair. Exactly. We've got all these different versions of awful contraception for women.
I'm really wound up now.
Yeah. Just to protect one little egg a month.
Exactly.
And there's millions of sperm out there that need to be, you know, controlled.
Exactly. But you're saying there is stuff in the pipeline.
Yeah, I've
only heard of the male pill. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, so there was
a
male pill.
Do they have a coil?
No, there's no coil. There was kind of at one point like a reversible kind of vasectomy thing, but that was a little bit.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, it was like sellotape round.
Yeah, they could sort
tubes,
of turn
it
on and off, and it wasn't great. But there has been a pill developed. I've met with and worked with a doctor a couple of years ago because I'm fascinated by contraception. It is literally life or death, or not life, but life but not life. Mm-hmm. And he had developed this pill that was non-hormonal, and I won't go into too much detail about the penis, but it basically stops the muscle that releases sperm into semen. So you would take it before sex.
It was like Botox.
Yes. Quite similar. Botox for the penis. Can we assume we can say penis? Yeah, yeah, you don't have like a limit on penises.
No.
Okay. So it would, immobilize this muscle that releases the sperm into the semen. So you take the pill before you have sex and it lasts for a certain amount of hours. But the doctor had got it down to, during his trial phases, taking it for hours before sex. I don't know 4 hours before I'm having sex. Like, absolutely not.
Who knows what's going to happen on a Saturday
night?
Nobody
knows. This is why, like, I shave my legs every day just in case. But he had to develop it to so that you would take it within around about half an hour to 15 minutes beforehand. And in order to get the funding for that, he approached investors and they went, no, not interested. And that would have been something that was, you know, non-hormonal, something very easily could be taken by men, both in long-term relationships and men who were having one-night stands, etc. But I spoke to a lot of male friends about it and it was really interesting and they went, ooh, you know, but would the women trust the men for having taken it? And I went, well, you trust us for taking the pill. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there has to be a mutual trust. And also we'd both need to have the options in order to trust each other and to protect ourselves.
Yeah. And also, oh God, that seems really bizarre to me. Would men trust the women? Why do you think men are sort of uninterested in this issue? Because there's a fantastic US comedian whose name I will look up because I'm going to plagiarise her joke in a minute. But she sort of says, you know, men are so kind of completely uninterested in contraception. It's as though they don't know sex equals babies. Yeah. They just think having sex might, the biggest risk from having sex is that you might get a girlfriend.
So true. But we're so removed from sex equals babies. You know, the pornography industry, you never come back to like, oh, 9 months later. Mm. You know, sex is sex because women have taken the brunt of the responsibility for everything that goes on after that. But I think it is a societal thing. Men have just never had to.
But it doesn't really impact on them, right? If you have a one-night stand, guy and a girl, for instance, that girl gets pregnant. That we have a culture where guys, it's kind of acceptable for them to not be the sole parent, to be basically, maybe I'll just throw some money. I might throw some money if I'm lucky. So really, how much is your life being impacted? It might be inconvenience because your one-night stand got pregnant and you weren't really planning that. It's not really affecting your life. Whereas a woman, that is a whole another show.
Absolutely. It's completely life changing. But even in these examples that we're talking about things like one night stands, casual sex. The majority, I mean, I don't have the facts, but I'm guessing that the majority of people who are having sex are actually in long term relationships.
I don't know. A lot of my long term relationship friends would say no. But yeah.
But you
especially
know,
the married
I mean.
Ones.
Yeah. Especially the married ones. However, it's those people that I'm thinking about, because really, if you're having casual sex and teenagers having sex, condoms for STIs and all that kind of thing. But when you think about sexual health clinics, you think about young people, teenagers, early 20s. But what about women who are in long-term, stable, monogamous relationships? It's those women that have to make that choice. And surely in that situation, the man is going to have just as much of an impact long-term because he's going to be a father to a child.
So who got it right? Because I'm sure a huge part of the women's lib movement in the 60s, 70s was about having contraception and being free from having to have children. Yeah. And now we're almost saying, oh, but the consequence of that is that my hormones are completely messed up and I felt depressed all of my life or subdued all my life and I've never really realized why. And so... At the time, it was a good thing. And sometimes time, when you put a spotlight on something, you can see just how bad it might be. But who's right? Who's right? Who's wrong?
Exactly. And I can understand the kind of the joy of being a woman in that period of time, especially, you know, the swinging 60s, etc. The joy of having protection against conception. But the dosages that women were being given for the pill back then were so much higher. I can't remember, was it 400% higher, something like that? Yeah. It was all trial period stuff. And what it was doing to their bodies then was so awful, so terrible. And I'm sure many women would go, oh no, I was on the pill in the 60s and I was fine. But we all have a friend, or all of us in this room, that have had a terrible experience on the pill. And the dosages that we're being given nowadays are lower than they ever have been. But still... I don't know if you know this, but some of the hormones used in the female pill have actually shown up in traces of water, tap water.
Yes, I don't drink tap water for that very reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But some people would say, you know, it's an imperfect system, but it is still a system that gives women control over their bodies.
Absolutely. I'm not denying that whatsoever, but that's not the point when we stop. in my eyes, you know. You know, we've got a female prime minister, therefore, you know, everything's equal. We need to keep on pushing forward. And it's actually, it's not as good as you might think, because in the UK, only one in two births are planned.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's as high as that?
Wow. Yeah, one in two births are planned in the UK. And that is obviously a much higher percentage than that are also unplanned, but abortions, etc., bring the number down. And we have free access to contraception in this country. And yet still.
People, what are you doing with your time? It's coming up to Christmas.
It's sperm, Harry.
It's when we all get
sperm's
a little bit...
Fault.
Well, it's when the sperm and sperm owners get a little bit...
Frisky
on the Christmas parties, and nobody's thinking about it. It is, you know, there's like a bump. You know, there's a bump in babies born around September time because everyone's having too much of a good time.
I'm 30th of September. I know what my parents are doing on New Year.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4. This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton. If you want to hear more from us, you can come follow us on social media at Badass Women's Hour, HR, or leave us a review and tell us how much you love us. We really need to feel the love. 5 stars should do it.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.